Good evening, everyone, and welcome to this second lecture in the Glasgow Centre for Population Health's fourth seminar series. It's amazing how time flies. My name's Carol Tannehill. I'm the director of the centre, and I'm delighted to see you all here, and in particular to welcome Geoffrey Bolton, who's going to be delivering this evening's lecture. I just want to mention a couple of housekeeping things to begin with, and the first one is really one just to minimise disruption. Those of you who are kind of up at the back on the left-hand side there, would you mind just moving along the rows slightly, because any latecomers will come in the back door and we then can get them seated with minimal disruption. That would be terrific. The second thing is, if you have mobile phones, could you please make sure that they're either on silent or switched off? And we're not expecting a fire drill tonight, so if the alarm goes off, the fire exit is at the back of the hall. So go out those doors or the doors here, whichever is nearest to you. And I think, lastly, just by means of announcement, some of you know that the Glasgow Centre is currently experiencing, I don't know if that's the right verb, but anyway, we are currently experiencing a funding review, and that involves an opportunity for, I guess, a relatively small number of people to be interviewed face-to-face, but there is an open opportunity for anybody to submit comments as part of the review process. So if you'd like to give any feedback on the work we do at the centre or any recommendations on what you'd like us to do in the future, we'd be very grateful for those. All feedback would be welcome, and you can do that simply by going in through the homepage of the centre's website. There are no standard consultation questions, so it's not going to take you very long, just an opportunity to send in an email with any feedback or observations you'd like to make. So that's all from me, and I'm going to hand over tonight to Duncan Booker, who's our chair for the evening. Duncan, as many of you will know, heads up the health policy team at the City Council. Thanks, Duncan.
Oh, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to this public lecture in the fourth seminar series organised by the Glasgow Centre for Population Health. It's a great privilege and a real pleasure to introduce our speaker today. Professor Geoffrey Bolton is Regius Professor of Geology and Mineralogy and also Vice Principal at the University of Edinburgh. He also heads up the Global Change Research Group, which is hosted in Edinburgh, and has just told Carol and I that he's recently arrived back from China, where he's been having discussions there with governmental and NGO representatives around global climate change and the role that China and its industrialization will be playing in that. He's also a member of the Prime Minister's Council for Science and Technology and General Secretary of the Royal Society of Edinburgh, which is Scotland's National Academy, and was a member of the Royal Commission on Environmental Pollution. Professor Bolton's own research, for which he has received a number of international awards, is concerned with environmental change and with implications for issues such as the disposal of radioactive waste. Now, Professor Bolton's work initially on glaciation has led him to an interest in Earth system models, in which oceans, atmosphere, cryosphere, and biosphere are coupled in the evolution of climate, and from there to a fundamental question of how human agency is shaping the planet and how it's now become as powerful and significant, perhaps, as those other forces. We've considered at various previous seminars, including in this very venue, how stress affects us, humans, and how it can do so differentially. Now we're going to hear about the kinds of stresses that we humans and our activities are putting our own planet under. The title of Professor Bolton's talk is Learning to Live with an Angry Planet, Human Relations with the Earth in the Past and in the Future. Professor.
Do a sound check first of all. If I stand here and speak, can you hear me?
Yes.
Good. Geologists are used to shouting from mountaintops in half a gale at their students. And I do speak as a geologist, and as a geologist, I look at our planet as a rather angry beast over the 4.5 billion years of its lifetime. And in relation to what's happening at the present day, I think my general comment would be the last thing you do with an angry beast is poke it with a stick, because you may not be sure what it might do to you. Most societies that we know of, whether they are large civilizations or small rural groupings, have views about their relationship to nature and the way in which they relate to it. Those views very often condition the way they live in a rather fundamental way, whether they tell themselves narrative tales about it or whether they use it as a basis of their economies. Really the impacts are very substantial. In our society, in the West and Western Europe, then much of the way in which we look at the earth we live in and the environment around it is conditioned by scientific discoveries. And I would say that there probably have been three or four great scientific discoveries which to some degree have addressed the overweening arrogance that the human species, that is we, are often guilty of. Copernicus showed that the Earth was not the center of the universe, but that it was a small planet in a rather insignificant star system on the edge of a major spiral galaxy. James Hutton showed that we were not, or it didn't seem to be, that we were the epitome of creation, but we came rather late in the day in an earth, as he wrote, was without vestige of a beginning, without prospect of an end. It's an attitude that somehow we are so important in the evolution of this earth that Mark Twain, who in a sense was a great scientist, wrote that who can doubt, he said, that the 1 millimetre of paint on the top of the Eiffel Tower was what it was built for. And subsequently, of course, Darwin, for at least the satisfaction of many of us, demonstrated that humanity is not the end point of a great highway of evolution, but rather the consequence of a series of rather chance events in a complex and difficult history. For most of my lifetime, the presumption has been that the human drama is played out against a static environmental backdrop, but somehow that we can exploit the earth in whatever way we wish, and the only consequence is that of our material benefit. At the same time, although we've known that the geological past has had contained events that are dramatic in the extreme, somehow that's part of the past, and it's unimaginably different, and the present is something rather different from that past. And of course, by saying all those things, what I want to suggest is that all these presumptions may be wrong. What I want to do is, first of all, to talk about the way in which we think the Earth works if it's left to itself. And secondly, how we might have affected the way in which the Earth works. This is something called Glomar Challenger. It's a drilling vessel that's sailed through the Earth's oceans now for the best part of 30 years, digging holes into the ocean floor. This is the result of the work of that vessel. Those young students of ours are carrying a core that's been taken from the middle of the Atlantic in a water depth of about five kilometres, and on the presumption that the Atlantic Ocean is an enormous settlement basin in which detritus from the continents is swept into the oceans, it settles onto the ocean floor, and in some sense we can infer something of the history of the Earth from that accumulation of sediment that sits on the ocean floor. Here they've opened the core up, and you can see sediment from the ocean floor here. And you can see that it's layered, and that layering is like the leaves of a book, which the latest page is right at the top, the earliest page is somewhere down at the bottom. And the key question is, can we read what's written on those geological pages to infer something about the history of the Earth? And the answer is yes, we can. And one of the ways in which we do it is that that sediment contains microorganisms such as this. This is a foraminifer. It lives in the ocean surface waters, but also on the floors of the oceans. It's about a millimeter in diameter or thereabouts. And it produces, it has in the chemistry of its shell, a signal that tells us about the salinity of the water in which it lived. And as a consequence, by working down those cores, we can deduce the changes of the salinity of the Earth's oceans through time. And if we do that, we get records like this. This record goes back about 3.5 million years. The timescale is based on the change in the Earth's magnetic field. And the oscillations you see here, from blue to the left and red to the right, are reflections of the salinity change of the oceans. Here, when it oscillates to the left, the oceans have a high salinity. When the curve oscillates to the right, they have a low salinity. And you can work out how big a change that implies. The easiest way to change the salinity of some water in a container is if you want to increase the salinity, you put a fire underneath it, drive off water vapor, and the salinity increases. If you want to decrease the salinity, you simply decant some fresh water into the bucket. Well, the oceans are like an enormous bucket, and we calculate how much water you would need either to evaporate or to decant in order to get the changes in salinity of that order of magnitude, and the answer is quite a large number. It's about 50 million cubic kilometres, which is a lot of water. And we think we know where that 50 million cubic kilometres goes to when it comes out of the oceans and where it comes from when it goes back into the oceans. We think it comes from the great ice sheets that have covered the Earth from time to time. I'd better go back one. We think that when the curve oscillates to the left, then most of Eurasia, including Scotland and Britain, most of North America, were covered by great ice sheets with an elevation of the order of 3 to 4 kilometres. When the curve oscillates to the right, then there are relatively warm conditions, similar to those of the present day. The present Earth has ice sheets in Antarctica and Greenland. They're about 50 million cubic kilometres worth of ice. But the cold Earth has another 50 million cubic kilometres, which comprises the great ice sheets on Eurasia and North America. And what we're seeing here is an oscillation of the Earth's climate through time between glacial periods in blue and cold and so-called interglacials, which are warm and red. The present day, in fact, you can't quite see it, but it comes up to about there.
And so we think the Earth's climate has been unimaginably different in the past.
This is a computer model of the ice sheets that covered Eurasia. We're starting here about 30,000 years ago, at which time we think there was a big ice sheet on Scandinavia. Britain wasn't ice covered, but the shoreline was much further out than the present day because of the growth of ice on Scandinavia and North America had taken water up from the oceans. As a consequence, you would have walked from the northeast of England and Scotland across to Denmark and to northern France because of the water that had been taken out of the oceans and put in the ice sheets. And if things work properly, this model will show you how these ice sheets fluctuated through time. This is about 30,000 years ago, and the ice sheet's growing. And for the first time, we've got an ice sheet nucleating on Scotland as the climate gets colder, and the ice sheets are growing together. They coalesce in the middle of the North Sea, and because they put an enormous weight on the Earth's lithosphere, on the Earth's crust, they depress the crust, and they depress it more than the sea level is lowered by the fact that water's been taken up into the ice sheets. This is the coldest part of the glacial period, about 18,000 years ago, about there, and now it's retreating again, and you see the ice sheet over Scotland disappearing. It's now in the northwest highlands only, and it then disappears about 11,000 years ago. What you will see is there's a complete continuous strait of the sea between the east coast and the west coast. Edinburgh, Glasgow would not have been on a sprinter train, but it would have been in a corridor or a canoe. And the reason for that, of course, is that the land had been pushed down so much by the load of ice that sea levels were relatively high, even though the global sea level was low. And in places like Oban, you can see these wonderful marine terraces on Kerrera and Lismore, which are a consequence of this sort of behaviour. So let's get rid of the ice sheet because we don't need it anymore. And let's look back again in time using these deep ocean records. This is a record again showing a proxy for salinity. High salinities here showing large amounts of global ice. Low salinities there giving us present day conditions, present day interglacial conditions. And we're looking back over 3.5 million years or thereabouts. And if you look back over the last 700,000 years, you see these great cycles between very warm periods like the present day, here, here, there, 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 and very cold periods with enormous amounts of ice on Earth at these points, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. These are 100,000-year cycles of climate change. The Earth is behaving in an extraordinary fashion. We're getting these enormous rhythmic cycles. In fact, if you wanted to, and it has been done, I've done it, you can actually write the music for this. It's in 1317th time, which I reckon most of you might find difficult. What's interesting, if you go back beyond 700,000 years ago, you find that the cycle isn't 100,000 years long, it's 41,000 years long. Equally rhythmic, but the wavelength is different. So that's the evidence of the oceans, but there's also other critical evidence which comes from the Earth's great ice sheets. This is a photo of the Antarctic ice sheet. You're looking over the surface of an aeroplane. The surface of the ice sheet's at about 3 kilometres in elevation. You're about 4.5 kilometres. You're looking through about 60 kilometres in distance, and you can see the flow lines on the ice sheet. This is a radio echo sound of trace. It's rather like an ordinary echo sound of trace. There's the surface of the ice sheet. The trace is taken from the aeroplane. And here you are identifying mountains beneath the ice sheet surface. That depth is about 3.5 kilometres. And so you see great valleys here between these mountains. These mountains are rather larger than the mountains of the Western Highlands. They're completely drowned by the ice sheet. This valley here is in fact the valley through which this very strong flow takes place. You can also see layering in the ice. Now that layering is very important because ice sheets are effectively accumulations, layered accumulations of frozen atmosphere. This is a photo from Greenland, an ice cliff at the edge of the Greenland ice sheet, and you can see the layering there. Those layers we know are annual layers. The snow accumulation in winter and summer look different. You can identify the individual layers. And if I had the time to count here, there'd be about 30 or 35 years of accumulation. If we look at this ice, which comes, of course, from the accumulation of snow crystals like this, those snow crystals soon, these delicate and beautiful things, are electrically unstable, and they soon melt and become bowl-shaped, spheroidally shaped like this. This is snow near the surface, and you can see there are lots of voids between the crystals. As that snow is buried by more and more snow, you find that the voids become smaller, the crystals are pushed together, and eventually these voids no longer connect with the present atmosphere. But the voids themselves have trapped within them air from the surface at the time when the snow fell on the surface. Some years ago, a whole number of us tried to persuade and succeeded to persuade the European Commission to fund a major enterprise to drill a hole in the middle of the Greenland ice sheet. You see the drilling camp here. And here you see we're taking a core from the Greenland ice sheet, analogous to the ocean core, except made of ice, of course. You can see that it's layered. We're looking here at ice that's at a depth of about 1.3 kilometres, and we know, for reasons which I'm not going to tell you, but are rational, that the ice from that depth has got an age of about 90,000 years. And here is my gloved hand holding 90,000-year ice, and you can see it's got lots of little speckles in it, and those speckles are bubbles of air. And the air is the air that was on the surface of the ice sheet 90,000 years ago. In fact, if you pop it into your gin, it crackles wonderfully because the bubbles explode because they've been under pressure. So old ice is wonderful for gin in a way that modern ice from a freezer isn't. And because we can extract the air from those bubbles, and because we can analyse the air, and because we know the time scale of these cores, and this happens not from Greenland but from Antarctica, there's the present day, here we're going back 600,000 years. This is the way in which the composition of methane in those bubbles changes through time. This is the way in which the composition of carbon dioxide changes through time. And this is the inference of temperature based on the chemistry of the ice, which is uses a technique which was developed by our own late and great Lord Kelvin. And what you will see is that the temperature record here shows the same cycles that we saw in the ocean. These 100,000-year cycles, these magnificent cycles of the warm interglacial periods here and the very low temperatures of the basal periods here. What you also see is that the composition of carbon dioxide follows the composition, the temperature signal, almost perfectly. There is no excursion of one without an excursion of the other. They clearly are linked in some quite fundamental way, and the question is how and why. Methane isn't quite so tight, but essentially you see the methane concentrations are high in the warm periods, here, and low in the cold periods.
That's an enormously important discovery. It is a reality, irrespective of how you explain it.
The question is, how do you explain it? Now, a few years ago, George Bush would have explained it by saying there is a process which causes carbon dioxide to fluctuate in the atmosphere, and that process is temperature. But the Earth's temperature varies through time, and that variation of temperature causes a change in the carbon dioxide concentration in the atmosphere. Well, there are many of us who don't think that's correct. Another fact is that if you do a very simple Newtonian calculation on the way in which the Earth's orbit around the Sun changes through time, you find there are three principal components of that orbit. And those components have different time scales of variation. And extraordinarily, those time scales of variation are 100,000 years, 40,000 years, and 20,000 years. Those are frequencies that are contained in that ice core and indeed in the marine record. In other words, it is quite clear that there's a relationship between the orbit of the Earth around the Sun and the way the tempo of climate change on Earth. Now, it's unreasonable to suppose, that climate change on Earth somehow determines the Earth's orbit around the Sun. Much more reasonable to suppose the Earth's orbit around the Sun is a consequence of planetary dynamics, and that it's that that's sending a signal to the Earth. Now, we can calculate, using the sorts of climate records I've shown you, the average change in global temperature from a warm period like the present day to a cold glacial period such as we had 20,000 years ago. And the average global temperature shift in that fluctuation is about 5 degrees Celsius. Doesn't seem very much. In some places, in Scotland, it was actually much, much bigger. It was like 15 degrees Celsius in Scotland, an average of about 5 degrees Celsius. We could compute what the consequences of these planetary changes were for the Earth's surface, for the temperature of the Earth's surface, and the computation, which I think is quite a robust one, says it was about, it was able to produce changes of the order of half a degree Celsius. In other words, the real change is 10 times bigger than the change that this process itself could produce. And so the idea is, this is the pacemaker of change. It's telling the Earth's climate the direction in which to move, but it's not the determinant of the magnitude of the change. And the question is, what is the magnitude? And scientists have worked on this for many years, and now there is a very general and a very broad consensus, which I guess some of you may not believe in. And it is this, that essentially the Earth's atmosphere is the Earth's thermostat. About 6 months ago, I gave my terrible bunch of third-year students a problem to solve. I told them the distance of the planets of the solar system from the Sun. I gave them the energy emissivity of the Sun and asked them to calculate the planetary surface temperatures. They all got them wrong. Now, they're quite clever, and the calculations as far as they went were just fine. But what I didn't give them was the planetary atmospheric composition, the composition of the atmosphere of each of the planets. I did that and then gave them the Arrhenius equation produced by a Swedish chemist 100 years ago, and they put that into the calculations and they got it right. In other words, the surface temperature of the planets of the solar system depend fundamentally on the composition of the atmosphere. It determines how much solar heat is retained by the planet. If that's true for Mercury, Venus, and Mars, there's no reason why it shouldn't be true for the Earth as well. I would argue it is. And most geologists now believe that this atmosphere is essentially the Earth's thermostat over long periods of geological time. There are two bits of it, of course. There's the atmosphere is essentially about 100 kilometres thick. But the bit that really matters to us is the troposphere, which is about 10 kilometres thick. When you're flying from here to Dubai or wherever you spend your weekends, then you fly just above the troposphere because that's the turbulent bit. And what you hope to do is scatter a jet stream which blows across the top of it. So weather is something that happens in the troposphere. And of course, the operation of that atmosphere is believed by most climate scientists to be a consequence of this greenhouse effect, whereby radiation from the sun, shortwave radiation from the sun, is intercepted by the atmosphere, or more generally intercepted by the Earth. It's re-emitted from the Earth's surface as long-wave radiation, and gases in the atmosphere essentially absorb that long-wave radiation, and they re-emit that energy as heat energy, which effectively warms up the atmosphere. And if one again does the calculations, and they are intrinsically quite simple, and then determine how the magnification of the solar signal might be produced, and if it could be produced by the changes in the carbon dioxide concentration of the atmosphere, the calculations come about right. In other words, if you want to amplify the solar signal of 0.5 degrees Celsius to make it 5 degrees Celsius, the change in carbon dioxide concentration from glacial to interglacial will do the job for you.
And so we geologists, at least, were convinced by this about 20 years ago. But of course, if one's going to
take it further, you need much more coherent and analytic processes than that. So that's about changes in the physical Earth, and why, at least most of us think, they take place on quite long time scales. Now let's have a look at life on Earth. And this is an object that was found about 15 miles from here about 10 years ago. Anyone guess what it is? Audience participation is permitted at this point. No, well, you can see it's very large.
It looks like it's a tooth that's been bent.
It's a tooth. It's a tooth that's been bent. It is a tooth that's been bent. It's actually a mammoth tooth. A mammoth's tooth, in addition to being a mammoth tooth. And this mammoth must have had terrible toothache, because normally this axis is straight and this is bent. And
that occurred during its lifetime. We know what that fella looked like.
Well, not that particular one, but the species looked like. This is a mammoth found in Berezovska in 1908 in Russia. It is said that it was served up as a steak at the International Geological Congress meeting in St. Petersburg in that same year. It's not said whether it was eaten or whether people were poorly because of it. You can see it's lost part of its trunk because the dogs got to it before their miners and scientists did, and it's now preserved in a terrible state in a museum in St. Petersburg. But there were people around, of course, who recorded those mammoths. And this is actually quite extraordinary. It was a find that was made some years ago at Creswell in Nottinghamshire. And it's our own Lascaux. These are the Paleolithic paintings on the walls of a cave in England. And here you see what we think is a mouth. It has a very distinctive dome-shaped head here. Its tusks are somewhere in here. And its trunk, that's its trunk.
We're not quite sure of the age of that, but it's about 20,000 years old, at a time when only about 50 kilometres north, the terminus of a great ice sheet covered much of Britain.
On the same wall, there are scribbles like this. And someone, quite remarkably, noticed that actually you could distinguish something in the scribbles, and they began to take them apart, and that came out. It's even been suggested that these rather prominent eyes are something else which we know from the modern day, where Inuit Eskimos used bone with slits in against snow blindness. And this appears to be a sketch of a contemporary human from some 20,000 years ago. It's interesting that it's been scribbled out, and one just wonders whether this might have been taboo. And of course, these humans, as humans tend to, got up to no good at all. And by 8,000 years ago, the mammoth populations were suffering desperately by mammoth hunters on the steppes of northeastern Europe and Siberia. This is a mammoth hunter's camp. About 9,000 years ago, they had seasonal camps. And what they've done here is use these are jawbones of mammoths. And they've used them essentially as boulders to hold down their skin tent. And the last mammoth we're aware of comes from Pribilof Islands, just off the northern coast of Siberia, and is dated at about 5,800 years ago. And we believe the mammoth was almost certainly extinguished as a consequence of human activity. But before that happened, we also see this is a sketch from the cave in northern Spain. And there's a mammoth, a very distinctive beast again. And this sketch is from about 13,000 years ago. And you can see this rather peculiar object here. And it almost looks as if the mammoth has been domesticated, and you're looking at some sort of
cage within which the mammoth is held, like a sheep pen.
Of course, this human occupation develops and evolves as climate gets warmer. And at the end of the glacial period, about 10,000 years ago, what had been a very strong oscillation of climate during the cold period the climate became much steadier through time, much simpler, and much warmer. But just before the beginning of the warm period, this in fact is the earliest tell from Jericho. It's dated about 12,500 years ago, and you can see the base of a tower here. And for me, at least, this is rather powerful as a symbol, because at the time when Jericho was a thriving city with streets that we would have recognised, and presumably merchants too, then Inverness, Glasgow, Oslo and Stockholm were covered by more than a kilometre of ice. In other words, a modern Earth was here, but an unimaginably different Earth was in a part of the world that we know. And I think, for me at least, that connects our modern Earth that's knowable and knowledgeable from this unimaginably different Earth of the past. One of the things that's also rather clear from the archaeological record, and it's become more and more clear as time has gone on, is that we see strong evidence of well-developed civilizations that founder. Now, it may well be that part of the foundering of those civilizations is a consequence of political activity, of warfare and the like, but it's also, because of association, it's becoming increasingly clear that much collapse of a number of civilizations that we know a great deal about may well have been produced by environmental degradation. These are three periods from the eastern Mediterranean region, which has been in the past prone during our present interglacial to perennial drought or periodic drought, where we have evidence of very sustained drought over long periods of time, which almost certainly would have diminished the productivity of agriculture. And of course, these civilizations were based on the capacity both to tax and to draw in agricultural production. And the major civilization simply cannot survive if the economic base, the agricultural economic base, is damaged. This is a powerful example from the Maya civilizations of Central America, which collapsed rather dramatically after a flowering of several hundreds of years. And we think we understand why it collapsed. This is an index of aridity. The further to the left you go in this graph, the more the wetter it is. Further to the right, the greater the aridity. This is time, 1500 years BC, present day here, and we see this phase during the later period of Maya civilization, when there were a series of very sustained droughts. And there is a great deal of evidence based on the nature of agricultural production, based on pollen analysis, that in fact the whole economic agricultural base of Maya civilization collapsed as a consequence of these sustained periods of drought. So it's happened before. The question is, can it happen again? Whilst this was going on, of course, the nature of the environment was changing. Those of you that have been up our Scottish mountains will recognise this sort of site. This is a peat bog. Yeah, it's on the side of Ben Lawes, and contained within the peat bog is a pine stump. That pine stump has peat on top of it, so it's not a modern pine stump. In fact, one can date that pine stump, and it's about 6,500 years old. This is some evidence from a place called Black Lock in Fifeshire. You see time on the left-hand axis from 14,000 years ago to the present day here. And let me direct your attention to this graph on the right-hand side. This shows the proportion of the total vegetation that is made up of trees here in black, or by grasses here in two lighter shades. And what you see is, at the end of the glacial period, about 10,000 years ago, about here, there had been largely a tundra landscape, a grassy tundra landscape. But after this, we see the expansion of trees, first of all, birch and pine, and then mixed oak forest and beech. By about 6,000 or 7,000 years ago, or 7,000 or 8,000 years ago here, we had largely a forest cover with some grassland. But after about 6,000 years ago, we see that the forest cover diminishes dramatically. And if we were able to carry the curve a little bit further to about 1,500, we'd see that the forest cover had diminished to almost zero. This part of the change is a consequence of the warming earth. We're replacing the tundra by mid-latitude forests. This part of the change is us. That's human occupation. It's the consequence of the cutting of forests to create arable land and pasture. And in Europe, we see northwestern Europe. We see very, very clearly this Neolithic and Bronze Age dramatic deforestation, particularly strong in the Bronze Age. And that essentially we've had in Europe a deforested landscape since Roman times. The nadir in Scotland was probably about 1750, 1740, where we had something like 7% of the total forest cover that had existed in the early part of the interglacial. And since then, of course, the forest cover has been increasing as a consequence of plantation for commercial purposes. So there's been a dramatic change in the forest cover. The human impact has been extremely powerful during that period, and the fundamental nature of the environment has shifted.
As we move through this period of time, from an early part of the interglacial when we had a strong forest cover, we had rich soils at that time. We had rich soils because the glaciers that had swept down from the highlands had broken off chunks of feldspar and pyroxene and amphibole and other minerals which contain within themselves the nutrients that plants need. They contain iron, manganese, potassium, phosphorus and the like. And when those minerals broke down by weathering, then they release those nutrients which are taken up by plants. Progressively, of course, during the interglacial period, then plants take up the nutrients and the soils start to deteriorate in their quality. In fact, if you make a map globally of soil quality, you find that there are two sorts of areas where there are good soils. One is where there are glaciers, or where there have been glaciers, and the other is where there have been volcanoes. Because those are sources of fresh mineral materials which can go on to provide nutrient for growing plants. The places which are inherently infertile are places where that has not happened. Australia as a continent is inherently infertile. Much of West Central Africa is inherently infertile. And of course human occupation, human activity has made things, has impacted on that dramatically. You might remember Charles Dickens in A Tale of Two Cities wrote of the best of times, the worst of times, and arguably the present epitomises that. You could say it's the best of times in the sense that even in the last 50 years, the average lifespan at birth has improved globally from about 46 to 64 years. And the gap between the developed and the developing world has diminished from about 24 years to a still disgraceful 12 years. So on the one hand, we have seen, clearly seen material progress, we've seen progress in human health. We may, however, also be on the verge of the worst of terms. Human populations in about 1830 were about 1 billion people. At the present day, it's 6.5 billion. By 2050, barring accidents, then we'll be at about 9 billion. If you ask, well, how do we feed that 9 billion? The answer is an interesting one, because arguably our capacity to feed people has been sustained over the last 30, 40 years by the so-called Green Revolution, where now, last year was the season of April, then about 50% of all the atoms of nitrogen and phosphorus that went into growing plants on the continents came not from the natural biogeochemical cycles which develop the biosphere and which struggle to sustain, but from artificial fertilizers. In other words, if you tell me that organic agriculture is a solution to the world's problems, you're not in the right ballpark. At the moment, our attempts to feed the world are largely based on artificial fertilizer, to a very great extent. And there is a severe doubt as to whether we may already have passed the Earth's carrying capacity in relation to the way in which we now live, what we eat, how we eat it, and the energy we use. The energy we use, individually now, we use about 14 times the energy subsidy that our hunter-gatherer ancestors had. And that energy has to come from somewhere, and we have to use it efficiently. There are many people who believe that the very phrase sustainable development itself may have been damaging the idea somehow that the development that we currently know is actually sustainable. Arguably, it's let many politicians off the hook. And if we look at the way in which we have depleted Earth resources, then our soil resource is massively depleted. It's depleted because we're losing vast quantities of soil. Last year in China, about 20 billion tons of soil found its way into the South China Sea and the Yellow Sea. And the reason it found its way there was because there was very little forest vegetation to retain it. And it's getting worse. At the same time, that soil is losing its natural fertility because of the processes I've spoken of, and the only thing that retains that fertility is artificial fertilizer. In terms of biological productivity, something like 60 to 65% of the total biological productivity of the continents we use for our own purposes. And we intercept and use about 70% of all the usable freshwater runoff for the continents. In other words, we don't leave very much for the other inhabitants of Noah's Ark. And I want to say just a few things about hydrocarbons and minerals, and then something about the atmosphere. You will have heard of this idea of peak oil. Well, there are now not many economists or geologists who seriously consider this issue who do not believe that we have either passed the point of peak oil production or are shortly coming to it, and the price rises we see at the present day are going to be sustained into the future. Cheap oil has been the basis of our economy for the last 100 years, and it is a questionable issue of whether we can replace it in ways that can sustain our current lifestyle. The atmosphere is something that on which we've had a major impact. This is a rather emotive slide, but nonetheless it's real, it happens. We're pouring CO2 into the atmosphere on a massive scale. If we look at the way in which, say, carbon dioxide and methane, about which I showed you graphs earlier, have changed through time. These are records from the ice cores. They're from exactly the same source as the other data that I showed you. They show the last 1,000 years, and you see in terms of carbon dioxide concentration, the normal interglacial concentration, which is about this level, has now in fact gone up to almost 400 parts per million, which is a rather outdated slide. It's about up here now, and the same is happening to methane. If we're right in saying that these atmospheric gases are part of the Earth's thermostat, then we ought to be concerned about what the impacts might be. This is the data plotted on one of those ice core records I showed you before. In red here, we're looking at carbon dioxide, and that's the natural record of carbon dioxide through time. That's where we are. In fact, we're here. We're about here now. In fact, we're higher. We have higher levels of CO2 in the atmosphere than we've known for about 30 million years. Is there anything to stop it going up here? We don't know. We don't know whether the Earth will suddenly begin to absorb, or the oceans will suddenly begin to absorb much of the excess CO2. If we look at the mean temperatures in the Northern Hemisphere computed from a whole variety of proxy records over the last 1,000 years, we see this dramatic shift in temperature. This rise in temperature now is of the order of 0.7 degrees Celsius on average. That might not seem very much, but of course it's more than a tenth of an ice age. So in global terms, it's a very large change. If you go to all the continents and look at the average temperature changes through time over the last 100 years, we see that in every case we see evidence of temperature rise. If we look at the records that derive from satellites looking at the top of the troposphere from the and the surface of the Earth, then these are the changes in mean annual temperature since 69. In the last 30 years, the changes have been dramatic, and you'll see that at the surface, the increases of temperature are particularly important and powerful in northern latitudes. The impacts are there already. These are representative images from central Ladakh from 69, 79, 89. They show the cover of snow and, in fact, glacier ice. The reason why that's important is during the dry season, something like 80% of the flow of the great rivers of the northern Indian plain, the Indus, the Ganges, the Brahmaputra, about 80% of that dry season flow comes from snow and melting glaciers. They, if you like, save it from one season and they let it come out of the other. Already in the last 15 years, we've seen dramatic reductions in dry season flow. Calculations by glaciologists now suggest that by 2050, most of the Himalayan glaciers will have gone. The impact on dry season flow of those great rivers will be dramatic in the extreme. They could be reduced 20%, between 20 and 30% of their current dry season flow, with devastating impacts on agriculture in both India and Pakistan, and indeed in Western China. This is an image of the Greenland ice sheet, great ice dome, about 3 kilometres thick. This is the area which normally, in former times at least, was an area of snow accumulation, with the melting restricted to the margins. Now you see the zone of melting is very, very much bigger, and systematically year on year we see the same. This is where there was going to be an animation of less summer sea ice concentration in the Arctic Ocean basin. Just in case it didn't work, I put in a picture. This is the extent of sea ice in the Arctic Ocean basin this last August. I think it's actually 25th of September. That's the area of sea ice there. You'll see that for the first time, you could have got through the Northwest Passage without any problem. Now that's the norm, that's been the average extent of sea ice in the summer. Last winter, for example, Spitsbergen here, which I know very well, there was no fjord ice at all last winter in Spitsbergen. The same is true in Alaska, and that is quite unknown. It's completely new. The models suggest that what ought to be happening is the impacts are going to be bigger in polar regions. The real observations show that they are. The key thing is that things like sea ice and glaciers, they're not emotional things. They don't respond to tomorrow's heat wave or less summer snowfall. They integrate climate through time. What they're telling you about is trends. They're much more reliable indices of trends than, let's say, a summer's weather. So, what about forecasting? And let me try to hurry through this quite quickly. First of all, we use computers. Why? We use computers because suggesting where cause and effect might lie in relation to climate is not something that is accessible to the sort of unaided reasoning that you and I typically do. We typically see a phenomenon here and say, what we ask the question, what caused it? And maybe there's something up here that we can imagine might have caused it. This is a coupled nonlinear system. All the elements of this system are interacting. It's a bit like having a billiard table and you've got 7 or 8 billiard balls, the reds all close together, you shoot the white into them, and you try to work out using your own brain alone where all the balls are going to go to. I doubt there are many of you that could achieve that. You actually need someone like a computer to do it. People talk about it's only modelling, but actually what it is, it's the encapsulation of all our best scientific theories that we can put our hands on. Don't forget, these are the theories that permit heavier-than-air machines to fly in the atmosphere, in which you are very happy to travel. And that's the climate system. Those are all the components of the system that interact together to create climate. 30 years ago, here, we could do computer simulations which assumed a flat Earth, they had precipitation, they had the sun, and they had CO2. Now the computer simulations we do are not far from an almost comprehensive cover of all the things that we can imagine might affect climate, and they include us in that. And if we look at the output from those models, we can run models in different sorts of ways. We can run one where we ignore human effects, like production of CO2 from the burning of fossil fuel, and we can do one where we incorporate human effects. And if we simply use natural effects and look at the 100 years from 1900 to 2000, that's the real change in our temperature in the Northern Hemisphere during that period of time. This is what we get if we simply only include nature, including volcanic eruptions, and you see that it's a pretty good match until about 1960, 1970, and then the two curves diverge very strongly. If you put in human impacts, particularly the gases that come from burning fossil fuel, you actually find the two match pretty well. In other words, in the last 30 years, we are seeing the human impact rise above the level of the natural signal of change. And the key, of course, is what are these emissions going to do in the future? Our presumption is that we're going to have massive increases in demand from China, from the US, but in fact all of us are going to increase our demand. If we use scenarios of the future use of fossil fuel and the greenhouse gases it will produce and look forward to the future, these are the sorts of forecasts that are created. Here we are, somewhere back here, well actually this is a rather old slide I'm afraid, and these are using different scenarios and they're suggesting the extents of global warming. You'll see values of about 4 degrees Celsius up here, values of 1 degree Celsius down here. So there's quite a wide range of forecasts. Don't forget that 5 degrees Celsius is our ice age interglacial transition, so it's a very big shift. The problem is that if we look at the emissions in the last 2 or 3 years, and they're plotted here on new data which became available in the last few months, the actual emissions now are way outside the most pessimistic scenarios that we used in those previous slides, which came from the International Panel on Climate Change. What's happened is that the rate of emission of greenhouse gases has doubled since the year 2000. During a period of time, we'll be telling ourselves somehow we're implementing sustainable technologies and sustainable energy production. It hasn't been happening, and things are getting worse. And if the impacts that the model suggests are going to occur, then we have to shift our thinking away from trying to ameliorate change by reducing emissions, which of course we must do, but we've now got to think about impacts. How are we going to adapt to things that are very, very likely to happen? So what's likely to happen? Well, these are model outputs showing the temperature changes we expect through the 21st century, given these really dramatic increases in temperature. You see values of the order of 6, 7, 8 degrees in polar latitudes, which have really very big impacts. You see precipitation changes too. And what you see is the lower latitudes get drier and the higher latitudes get wetter. A warmer Earth is a wetter Earth because more moisture is evaporated. But a warmer Earth is also a more energetic Earth. The climate is more energetic, right? The winds and the oceans circulate more rapidly, and they push precipitation towards the polar regions and away from the middle latitudes. And of course, the middle latitudes are the areas of greatest agricultural production, the concentration of population, and of course, the greatest concentration of poverty. If I touch on a medical issue, you all remember the 2003 heat wave in Europe, which produced this excess of deaths, particularly in France during the summertime. Well, this is a forecast of temperature till 2100. You know, one shouldn't take this too seriously. It's not a specific forecast. And the variability here is based on the statistical analysis of previous variability. That's the sort of temperature that was reached in the summer of 2003 in Paris. And what it suggests, as it says here, that by the 2040s, those temperatures will be normal. And by the 2060s, those temperatures will actually be rather cool.
And I leave to your imagination what the impacts of that might be. Now,
it's also worthwhile recognizing the fact that from time to time in the Earth's history, that the really dramatic and unpredictable changes. And I've just selected one here because it's actually quite photogenic. This stuff has come from a core taken on the western continental shelf west of Shetland. And it looks like ice. In fact, it's methane. It is solid methane. Methane goes solid when the temperature's quite cold, not very cold, but quite cold, and pressures are high. And under many of the Earth's continental shelves, there is this solid methane, so-called methane hydrate, which is frozen and is locked into the sediments of continental shelves. The volume of it is enormous. It is a vast volume. Here you see the methane burning. It's nice to see a snowball burning and someone holding a burning snowball in their hands.
Quite a party trick.
If that methane hydrate were to be released from the continental shelves because the oceans are getting warmer, what it would do would be to acidify the oceans on quite a big scale and with massive consequences for marine life in the oceans and much else besides.
Also the capacity of the oceans to absorb carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. Well,
we have evidence that it's happening. This is a core from the Atlantic, and there are many more like it. This shows normal deep marine sediment, it's also shown here, which is full of carbonate. The tiny fossils I showed you at the beginning made of calcium carbonate. Suddenly the carbonate disappears. And the reason is, we can infer quite readily from this, it's because the oceans are getting very acid, and what's happening is that all the carbonate in the oceans are being dissolved. You can see that's a straight line, it's a very sharp line. Well, we think that's about 700 years. And the total duration of this epoch, when the oceans were acidified, was about 1.5 million years. It happened here, only about 50 million years ago, which is nothing really in geological time. It happened at a point when we had this extreme warming of temperature, and it looks as if what happened was that the ocean margins warmed up, the methane hydrates were released, went into the atmosphere, warmed the atmosphere, and at the same time produced this dramatic consequence in the oceans. Could it happen again? Yes. Are people researching it? Yes, they are, very, very seriously indeed. Do I think it's likely? No, I don't. But it's just an example of the sorts of catastrophes that have happened in the past. Now, if one thinks towards our present mindset, which is, you know, global warming, all that is sort of, well, it's in the future somewhere, what do you think that, I mean, if there, well, I'm sure there were moderately intelligent descendants of dinosaurs here. I mean, what would they think? Well, it's getting a bit warmer, that's all. And then suddenly, bang, it happens. In other words, in Earth history, accidents do happen quite regularly, and the consequences are very serious. Well, just let me very briefly wind up. First, say that I find it really quite, I was going to say distasteful, but not quite that. I find it quite difficult to stand up in front of an audience like this and somehow give you what one could quite readily interpret as a scare story. And am I worried? Yes, I am. I do think these issues are extremely serious. Could I be wrong, and the majority of scientists who are involved in climate research be wrong? Yes, of course they could. There may be processes in the Earth which will inhibit this, but the question is, what sort of probability are you prepared to accept as not worthy of attention? Is it 5%? Is it 50%? Is it 90%? Would you say that if it's only a 50% probability, we wouldn't do anything? Well, if I told you there's a 50% probability that there's a hungry man-eating lion just outside the door, I'm pretty sure none of you would go out of it. And of course, in our individual lives, we're always used to coping with uncertainty. One of the difficulties, of course, is that politicians tend to say, well, come on, you're a scientist, tell us what's safe, tell us about certainty. What they don't understand is that science is not about certainty. It never has been about certainty. It is about uncertainty, primarily. Most of our theories are wrong, it's just that we don't actually yet know how they're wrong. One could, of course, say, well, these sort of things happened before. Malthus, you might remember, over 100 years ago, drew attention to a dawning population problem, which never materialized in the way he thought of it. It may be materializing now. We just don't know. 30 years ago, the so-called Club of Rome produced a book called Limits to Growth, in which they were arguing we would run out of resources. One might contrast that mindset with the mindset of a typical economist, a classical economist, who will say to you that the availability of resources, presumably atmospheric resources as well, is dependent simply on market demand. Well, actually, you know, things do run out, and the question for us is, are they? Can we cope with these problems if they are as substantial as they might be? I would say, no, we can't. I think some of the trends that might be in the process of working themselves through could be trends within the next decade. We're already seeing dramatic impacts in the Arctic. There are whole Inuit communities that are moving location because their lifestyle is not sustainable anymore. Within the next decade, we may see, even here in Scotland, changes that are really quite difficult to cope with, and the processes of government can't cope with it. Clearly, the energy issue is a vital one, because we must somehow try to hold back emissions. Can we cope with it? It's not clear that we can. I mean, we certainly haven't made any progress in the last 7 years. Maybe this is a rather indelicate thing to say in Scotland, but maybe the nation state is just the wrong political body to cope with these things. The fact that our mindsets are encapsulated within boundaries, within histories which reinforce those boundaries, and actually the idea somehow that we might be able to work together is very, very difficult to achieve. One of the problems, of course, is cheating. We'd like to think that everyone will do their bit, but actually it doesn't really matter if we don't, because Scotland's emissions are insignificant. And it reminds me of the problem of the MMR vaccine, where essentially there is a small but finite risk to your child if you take that vaccine. And if you take the view that I'm not going to have my child subject to that risk, you're essentially cheating. Because what you're also depending upon is that the herd immunity, which will be achieved by large-scale vaccination, will be achieved because other people have their children vaccinated. And somehow how we get rid of the problem of cheating, the problem of the global commons, and how we act together in order to be able to ensure that some of the consequences of this angry planet might visit us with in the way that it has in the past are somehow set at bay. The title of this talk almost implied that I have some answers for you, but I'm afraid I don't. Thank you.